He's not as experienced as this six demon yet, but he'll probably be experienced in a couple of years' time. So far, he's not off the team. He can be on the team with a good end of the season and a good playoffs as well. So I think the experience in this six demon that we have chosen so far is very important. And that's one of the reasons they are picked to be on the team.
That, speaking about John Klingberg not named to Team Sweden's entry, at least the initial preliminary roster for Team Sweden for this upcoming World Cup of Hockey, the Team Sweden did name six defensemen, which is an unusually high amount of players. Oliver Ekman-Larsson, Victor Hedman, Niklas Chalmerson, Erik Karlsson, Niklas Kronwall, Anton Strålman. No John Klingberg yet, although he has still an opportunity to be named as part of the next seven.
I would be shocked if John Klingberg wasn't the seventh defenseman. How do you leave John Klingberg off the team? He's got 50 points right now for the Dallas Stars.
He has the fourth most points among...
53 points.
53 points. He's got the fourth most points among Swedish players that are in the NHL this season, yeah. So he is ahead of Louis Eriksson and Philip Forsberg, who are both, you know, forwards, in case you forgot about that. So it is a bit surprising that Klingberg was left off the team. I'm surprised that he was left off. They went with 70. Like, why does Anton Strålman...
60.
Pardon me, 60. You know, I'm not sure why Strålman needs to be named that soon to the team.
I mean, there's the obvious connections between Strålman and Hedman in Tampa Bay. Yeah. I mean, Strålman is a good defenseman. I realize that Jets fans don't like him too much this year with what he did to Brian Little, but he's a solid. He's kind of like your stay at home guy on this team, right? You got a lot of offensive minded defensemen. We talked about it during the first segment covering the preliminary World Cup of Hockey rosters. I mean, this Swedish defense. I know the biggest surprise was probably Drew that they named six defensemen, but you even look at that forward group, and you could probably say maybe that the forward group is not as talented as the Canadians or maybe even the Americans, but that group of defensemen, and then throw in the fact that Henrik Lundqvist and Markstrom are excellent goaltenders. To me, Sweden has to be considered a favorite again, and they're defending Olympic silver medalists. So the Swedish team is always a threat in this tournament.
Yeah, this is a team that will be no surprise if they're in the final game. And I think when you look up and down that roster, tons of experience there, leadership. I mean, you got a number of captains on this team, a lot of intelligence from a lot of these guys, just really smart hockey players. And that's what I'm looking forward to. Maybe this isn't as flashy as a Russia team or as defensive as a Team USA, but just a smart, well-balanced team. And to me, all the guys I would expect, at least as far as a preliminary roster goes.
Yeah, I think this is, they picked eight of their top nine Swedish scorers in the National Hockey League were picked in terms of forwards to this squad. The only one, the omission, I think you could talk about, I think it'll be a shoo-in, is Carl Soderberg, how valuable he's been for Colorado playing in all situations. Sweden's interesting, though, because I think these were the easier decisions. I mean, there's not, they don't really have a ton up front after this. And, defense, they have more. Defense is not a question. We talked about Klingberg and Hampus Lindholm, guys like that. I mean, they have a lot of depth on the back end, and we know who's going to be between the pipes and Lundqvist. Mm-hmm. If you look at their forwards, you're going to see, Gustav Nyquist, I think, probably gets on the squad. You see, a Victor Rask, but there's a pretty big drop-off after the guys they've named. You could say Soderberg as one, and then maybe Hornqvist and Zibanejad, but there's no – you're not talking, Claude Giroux. But at the same time, their defense is so good and their goaltender is so reliable that and Mike talks about how smart their forwards are, and I totally agree, and they can play both sides and a great a lot of those guys can play a good two-way game. I just think they're going to need production from those forwards to score, because they're not going to get the depth production 1 through 12 that maybe some other teams have.
Yeah, Richie, those were the two guys. Well, I guess Carl Soderberg you could throw in there too, but Patrick Hornqvist, who's having a pretty underrated year in Pittsburgh, and then Gustav Nyquist, who's got tons of speed and skill. I think whether you put those guys on a top line or you have those guys on your third or fourth lines, there is a lot of skill on this team. Now, do they lack a little bit of size up front? I would say probably they do, but it's very similar to the way Team Canada is constructed in the way that excellent in goal, they've got speed and size on defense. I mean, and you've got seven really good defensemen, whether it's John Klingberg or, as you mentioned, Hampus Lindholm. I mean, Hampus Lindholm would probably make most teams in this tournament, right?
Excellent. I guess Lindholm, I should go ahead and Lindholm, I guess, wouldn't qualify because he'd be on the under 23 team.
Okay, so let's take Lindholm out. Whether Klingberg, whoever the seventh defenseman is, Richie, the top six defensemen that were named are all top defensemen on their respective teams, right?
Yeah.
And the Swedish team, you know, is always going to be competitive. The Sweden team is rarely not, at the very least, in the semifinals of any tournament. And, you know, we've seen how good they've been in previous years at the World Juniors, you know, with Finland as well, with, you know, Patrick Laine and Puljujärvi you know, Aho and all these guys that have been coming up. So Sweden, I don't think Finland is in the conversation, but I think along with Canada, the U.S. and Russia, Sweden always has to be considered a favorite.
I don't know if this is maybe I'm overstating it a bit, but like, is there a thought in Sweden that like they're not developing enough forwards here? Because I mean, the Sedins are not going to be playing much longer, and if you see the Sedins move on, and Zetterberg, if you take the Sedins and Zetterberg out of this for the next say Olympics, there's a pretty big gap at forward there for
Alex Steen's not getting any younger either. I mean, he's already 32, 33 years old.
Yeah, no, he would be 31 right now, right?
32, apparently.
They're turning 32 this year. But
turned 32 4 days ago, in fact.
There you go.
Yeah. So
it's been a question in a lot of the European countries. Czech Republic, another one, where how good were they 10, 15 years ago? And now hardly even in the conversation as far as Olympic Games go. And when you look at this roster, you see, you know, the Sedins, I'm just waiting for that year. They just fall off considerably. Right. And the Vancouver Canucks obviously struggling and probably not their fault, but not the dominant players that they once were. And as you look at this team getting older and older, who's going to take the next generation of Swedish hockey players into medal categories like we expect out of this group.
To your point, Richie, I mean, you look at the, you know, the next wave. I mean, Landeskog, of course, is probably a top of that wave. And then you got, you know, you mentioned Nyquist, and then there's guys like Elias Lindholm or Mika Zibanejad. I mean, they're good players, but they're not at the Sedin level, and they're not at the Zetterberg level.
Well, remember when Sweden won in 06, you were talking Forsberg, Sundin. Mm-hmm. And you were talking big time, and then you had Zetterberg, and then your Sedins were down. Like, the depth chart had just dominant players throughout, and you're just not – I don't think you're necessarily seeing that. So I'm just wondering, just from a Swedish perspective, you know, is there – and then Mike talks about the Czech Republic, too. I mean, look at the world team. I mean, in reality, have those teams been producing the top-end talent? Would they even have a world team, or would they be – would they have more of these nations with their own players?
Well, I was going to say we'll talk about the world team coming up, but go ahead.
Well, regardless of the, you know, lack of maybe premier prospects coming up, a hallmark of Swedish teams are, we talked about the goaltending, but they're very structured. They play probably, along with the Finns, the closest to the North American style, right? We know that. And they always play with speed, and they can always hurt you from four different lines. That's always been a staple. And in this tournament, they're going to be very hard to defend against. I mean, you're still talking about, even though the Sedins are you know, in their mid to late 30s now, and Henrik Zetterberg is towards the end of his career, I mean, you're talking about guys that can make plays. They have playmakers, and they have guys that can shoot, and they have guys that can jump up into the play on defense. Whether that's Victor Hedman, Erik Karlsson, Oliver Ekman-Larsson, a lot of skill there. They always seem to play well as a group internationally. That's been a staple. I mean, the Swedes, especially, you know, I think 2006 winning gold at the Olympics was huge for Swedish hockey. Not that they weren't good, because if you go back to 1994, you know, Billy Ranford, everybody remembers that, Lillehammer. I mean, the Swedes have been a force to be reckoned with in hockey for well over 30 years, 40 years. But I still think, you know, Drew mentioned some of the other guys, Landeskog and Zibanejad, who are too young to be on this team. I mean, they still produce really good hockey players.
Right now, when you look at this roster, I look at Henrik Lundqvist and then that group of defensemen. I feel really good. The other goaltender they've named is Jacob Markstrom. If I take Lundqvist out of the equation, I suddenly feel very different about this roster. And I wonder, you know, with Lundqvist getting banged up the other night, I don't know that it's anything serious or long-term, but when you think of a team that is so relying on one goaltender to really carry them and can be so suddenly different, different if an injury or situation would come up. That's got to be a little bit of a scary. But now we're debating over backup goaltenders. I think that's a good problem to have if you're one of these teams.
Absolutely.
That's why I guess I was right the first time around, because the Sweden wouldn't have the 23 age limit. So I was right. So Lindholm is in the picture for the Swedish team. There is, my apologies.
It's only the North American countries.
Which, again, okay.
I know. We've said it ad nauseum. It's not a best-on-best tournament. Don't rip your hair out if, you know, your preferred country doesn't win. It doesn't make any sense. Team Russia. We got a couple minutes where you can spend on Team Russia. They announced their 16. They got the forwards, but I think it's pretty clear that their defense is what's going to be their problem entering into this tournament. They named only three defensemen, Dmitry Kulikov, Andrei Markov, and Dmitry Orlov of the Washington Capitals. That's just not going to get it done, I don't think, in this tournament.
And I feel like Markov's not even a guy that I would put on in any of these rosters. It's probably a, hey, thanks for your dedication over the last two decades.
That's right.
But from what I've seen of Andrei Markov, I'd be a little scared of throwing him up against some of these talented teams.
Yeah, Mike, this Russian defense, well, at least the first three defensemen that were named, they're certainly not as talented as any of the top three defensemen on Canada or Sweden, for example. Mm-hmm. But Kulikov has really impressed me. I was telling this to Richie when we were down in Florida. I think Kulikov has improved a lot as he's gotten a little bit older. He's still very young. And then you throw in Orlov, who's had a very nice season in Washington. They can still move the puck. And you look at that group of forwards, and that's still a very talented group of forwards there with Ovechkin, Kuznetsov, Tarasenko. The list goes on and on and on. So this is a team that's going to score goals, and we know that the Russians can come together very quickly. So, you know, are they going to be able to win the close games? When it gets down to it, are they going to get those goals? Or are guys like Alexander Ovechkin, going to forget how to score like they have in big games, you know, going back to the 2010 Olympics, 2014 Olympics? But this Russian team, I still think you never want to count them out.
The Russian team is the Edmonton Oilers. A bunch of amazingly talented forwards who never get the puck because their defense can't get it to them.
There are 10 Russian defensemen playing in the NHL this year. Like that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's nothing.
True. You picked, Ezzie and I kind of talked about this, but you have, and I like Kulikov's improved game, Ezzie, but he's a second-pairing defenseman in the National Hockey League. Markov is not a top-end defenseman anymore. His mobility is almost completely shot. And Dmitry Orlov, I mean, again, you have him really playing well with the Orpik injury and Carlson injury. There's been factors there, Orpik and then Carlson. Mm-hmm. But in reality, he's your third-pairing guy on a top team in the National Hockey League. So you're going to go up and use these guys then and elevate them to play against, as we mentioned, Crosby's line, Sagan's line. They're not even trusted by their NHL coach to play against those guys.
Another team with goaltending questions, too. Sergei Bobrovsky, Semyon Varlamov, and Andrei Vasilevsky. I mean, Sergei Bobrovsky, I don't know what his status is at this point, longer term. I mean, this is a guy that's really, really struggled with injuries, has to be questioning himself every time he kind of goes into the butterfly, and we'll see what happens as far as his health goes. Varlamov, not the same goaltender, at least consistently this season. Mm-hmm. We've seen flashes of him and how great he can be, but at the same time, we've seen kind of the worst of Varlamov. So for a team that doesn't have great defense, doesn't have a lot of depth, and now questions in goal, that's got to be a little bit scary.
Yeah, 9-8 games is what Russia's going to want to play in this tournament. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll look at the Team Czech, and we'll look at Team Finland, and we'll look at Team Rest of Europe. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Yeah, I think all these goalies in this tournament will be good, and I think we have two good ones too. So, it's just like any tournament. It's just going to be a game of inches and maybe a lot of one-goal games. So that their experience will come in play, I think, in those tournaments. So we feel good about our choice.
That was Satan himself, Miroslav Satan, former, of course, Buffalo Sabre. Where else did he play? Did he play for the Oilers?
Yeah, he played for the Oilers.
Pittsburgh, New Jersey.
Yeah. Certainly bounced around. Anyways,
Miro Shatandru. He was
everywhere. I thought you were Lucifer.
Yeah, no, I'm Beelzebub.
He was drafted by the Oilers, I think.
We should play Sympathy for the Devil. We can, by the Stones, we can name all the different names that there is for the Devil right now. Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life. Illegal Curve is thrilled to be participating in the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life. Join IC on June the 5th in raising money for the Riverview Health Center's Alzheimer and Dementia Awards by cycling in the event or contributing to Team Illegal Curve. For more information about the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life or to join Team Illegal Curve, visit rhcf.mb.ca. Let's talk about Team Rest of Europe or Team European Union or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, they're...
I think it's just called Team Europe, Drew.
Okay, well, Team Europe then.
Sure, maybe European Union, Drew, that would mean more teams.
Well, it would mean more teams, that's right. The teams, Team Rest of Europe, they're not a bad team by any stretch of the imagination. I think they're better than, I would say they're better than the Czech Republic, certainly. I mean, you look at some of the big names of players they have there, Anze Kopitar, Marian Hossa, you know, Thomas Tatar, Franz Nielsen, Leon Draisaitl still coming into his own. I think their issues are going to be on defense, where Zdeno Chara is going to try and, you know, be the leader of that team on defense.
Well, their best defenseman is Roman Josi, Drew. I mean, that's their best defenseman, most mobile, most trustworthy at this point. Yeah, you mentioned that Chara in name certainly has is going to have a role, a big role. And Sadenberg and Sequeira, you know, the older guys. But Josi is the guy they're going to rely on. But the Mark Streit's also there. And when you ring off all of those names on the back end, Josi being obviously the most mobile, Streit and Chara, certainly their lack of mobility, I'm sure, will be something that will be taken advantage of by opposing teams. It's not the worst defense you've ever seen, but it's not overly impressive. And their goaltending with Anderson and Halak is fine. I actually like Frederik Anderson. I don't mind Jaro Halak, but it could steal you a game, but it could cost you a game just as easily, probably more likely, based on the talent they're playing against. And the forward group is pretty solid. Again, I'm taking issue with the tournament itself, but I look at how many Danes are in this group, and I think wouldn't it have been great to have a small mini tournament before, like a play-in tournament with all these teams, and allow them to have that national pride? I mean, if I don't know if you saw the end of last game when the Islanders played on Thursday, when Ehlers had the injury, Franz Nielsen kind of went up to him after the game and gave him a tap. You know, that's a guy from Denmark to another guy.
From
Denmark, who's, you know, kind of taking care of their own and making sure he's okay. And I just think that lack of pride, I honestly think that's a factor in playing this tournament. Like, I think that they will not play with the same passion. Like, it'll be similar for me to the young guns, but the young guns will have the commonality of being under 23. Mm-hmm. These guys are just putting a bunch of players together, and what are they playing for? Like, are they playing for the upset? Are they playing? Like, there's no national pride. I just don't see how it works.
They're playing for the European Union, Richie.
What is the anthem, I guess, is the other question. Is it a remix of other anthems?
They're not playing anthems at this tournament.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Which I have an issue with, too. But
with national pride, I think, also comes another angle of familiarity. This is a team that's almost like an all-star team thrown together. At least on some of these other groups, you've had guys that have grown up together, played in some of these world tournaments. Here, you've got a mismatch of guys that, I think, I agree, forwards, decent depth there, some good players in the Hossas and Kopitars, but I worry about how's this team going to come together in such a short time.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, Mike. You look at the roster, and there's talent, and they might be a little bit thin on defense, I would argue, a little bit older. Mark Streit and Dennis Seidenberg and Zdeno Chara, still good defensemen, but I would say that their best years are a little bit behind them. And you're right, Drew. I mean, he'll be the captain, Zdeno Chara. He will be the captain of this team. And, you know, lots of talented forwards. You went over a lot of them, you know, led by Anze Kopitar and others, Thomas Tatar. Lots of skill. But to me, looking at this team, are they going to be able to defend against the teams like Canada and the U.S. and the Russians, the teams that are the most talented up front? And I think they're going to have trouble defending against those teams. And that's why, even though I think they're going to be very exciting to watch, this tournament as a whole, I think Drew and I were talking about it off air with you guys. I mean, I've started to get a little bit more excited about the World Cup of Hockey, especially, you know, going back to last summer when I really wasn't that excited when the format came out. But there's going to be so much skill and talent on the ice, and it's going to be a great showcase for hockey. But I think when you talk about some of these other teams like Finland, Czech Republic, the European team, they just don't have as much skill as some of the other top teams. And that's why I would be surprised, you know, if they're going to win this whole thing.
Are you surprised to see a Leon Draisaitl on this roster, a guy that started the season in the minor leagues and has certainly gotten a great opportunity with the McDavid injury and what he's done in Edmonton? We'll see a little more of him tomorrow night in Winnipeg, but a guy that is going to get a great opportunity to show he belongs on the world stage here.
It is a great opportunity for him, and I think to me, a guy he's always reminding me of is actually an Anze Kopitar. So, you know, does he go under the guy, like a guy like that's wing and learn more about the game and play that way? But yeah, it's going to be you know, you're thrusting this guy like that into a significant pressure situation. So others probably like it because he gets tested to a point where, you know, maybe with Team Germany, if there was again a mini play in, then you get in. But otherwise, you probably this is not something where you'd see a guy like that play in this kind of a tournament at that young of an age.
And I think Draisaitl Richie, one of the reasons why he was included, because he played Western Hockey League, right? So he's played on the North American ice surface, not only in the NHL and AHL, but in his junior days, as opposed to maybe some other players, you know, who were used to the international ice surface. So good for Draisaitl. I think, Mike, I was a little bit surprised that he was included, just because he's only 20 years old, but good for him.
Team Finland is another one of the entries in the World Cup of Hockey. They're, of course, led by their goaltenders, Tuukka Rask and Pekka Rinne. I would say Rask will probably get the bulk of the starts there, as he's had a much better season than Pekka Rinne has. You know, the Finns are a team that sort of everybody always counts out and always perform well on these international stages. We saw it. You know, nobody had many hopes for them in Sochi, and they ended up with a bronze medal, of course, Teemu Selänne's final international hockey competition. This is a similar Finn team to what you saw in Sweden, in Sochi, rather. You know, Sasha Barkov's going to be their best offensive talent, and then on the back end, you have, you know, Olli Maara, who you're familiar with there in Pittsburgh there, Mike, Sami Vatanen. You know, it's a bit of a mixed bag of a team.
Yeah, it's not a great team on paper. It's not. I mean, but the Finns always play hard, and they always, and by play hard, I don't just mean effort. I mean they're usually hard to play against. They're in your face. They make you earn your ice, your space on the ice. And in a tournament like this, when sometimes teams play a little bit too fancy because there's so much skill, the Finns usually do a good job of simplifying their game, and that's usually the key to their success. I agree with you, Drew. The most, I think, the best player up front for them is going to be a Sasha Barkov. But, you know, you look up the middle for them, and they're pretty solid up the middle. Barkov, you have Koivu, Filppula, and Granlund. You're able to, you know, if you're pretty good up the middle there, then take some pressure off. On the back end, you have guys like Vatanen and Ristolainen on the right side who can move the puck. Mata, who's probably more of your... Mike could speak more to this, but more defensively inclined, but, you know, can move the puck as well, and then solid goaltending. So one of those teams where I don't know if they'll ever be a favorite in the game, but they'll never be an easy game to play.
We talked about how old Team Sweden looks and Team Czech. This is a team that's young.
Yeah.
This is a new era of Team Finland hockey.
Yes.
We're used to the Teemu Selännes and Olli Jokinens and that era.
That's right.
Very successful hockey. But when you start to talk about Mata and Barkov, who I think this could be his kind of coming out party, a guy that doesn't get nearly enough attention and credit for what he's doing in Florida as really a potential franchise player down there and a very good value locked up for them, I think this could be a great opportunity for this team to show, hey, we've got some young talent on the way. This is going to be the next generation of Team Finland hockey.
We'll do Team Czech Republic coming up a little bit later on in the show. A quick update from Winnipeg Jets game day skate. Jacob Trouba out of the lineup today. He's got an upper body injury. He is possible tomorrow against Edmonton. They'll see how he feels, which means Josh Morrissey makes his NHL debut tonight on the Jets' left side of the defense, playing with Tyler Myers. Nikolai Ehlers, he saw the doctor. The bleeding in his eye has stopped, which is obviously a good thing. Not expected to be a long-term injury. He'll see a specialist in about a week or so, still out at least for the next week, probably a little bit longer.
So, yeah, it's great news for Ehlers.
And great news for Josh Morrissey, who gets to make his NHL debut today on the Jets' back end. The forward group for the Jets, Stafford, Scheifele, Wheeler, Perreault, Burmistrov, and Armia, Marco Dano, Adam Lowry, and Chris Thorburn, and a fourth line of Matt Hauschuk, Andrew Kopp, and J.C. LaPone. It'll be something. It's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province to talk about the Canucks and their strange trade deadline lack of moves. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. The third hour of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by the 44th annual Rady JCC Sports Dinner, featuring keynote speaker and Pro Football Hall of Famer Dan Marino. The dinner is coming up on Tuesday, June the 21st, and will also honor former Chicago Bears player and University of Manitoba Bisons product Israel Adonijay. To purchase tickets, visit RadyJCC.com or call 204-477-7513 for more information. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Also joining us on the show all day today, Mike Colligan, who covers the NHL for Forbes Sports Money, joining us as he makes a trip to Winnipeg to watch the Jets play against the Habs and the Oilers this weekend.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Ben Kuzma. Ben covers the Vancouver Canucks for the Vancouver province. He joins us from San Jose, where the Canucks are in action later on this evening against the Sharks. Ben, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing very well, Ben. Obviously brought you on to discuss the Vancouver Canucks and their odd trade deadline. It's now been about 5 days since the deadline passed on Monday afternoon. Is it still as furious a response in Vancouver to the lack of moves made by general manager Jim Benning?
Well, I think what's kind of resonating through the populace right now is the fact that the Canucks decided to have one of their many town hall meetings yesterday in Vancouver with season ticket holders. And we weren't allowed to attend, of course. But some of the stuff that filtered out of there was quite surprising. We're kind of getting mixed messages from the top. At one point, Trevor Linden, the president of Hockey Ops, was telling the town hall meeting that they knew they were not going to be a playoff team this year and that we're going to approach the season in that manner. Well, it was just a few weeks ago when Jim Benning told us if Brandon Sutter was healthy and Alex Edler hadn't got hurt, there's a good chance the Canucks probably would make the playoffs, and that might affect what they were going to do at the trade deadline. So for everything that didn't occur, what occurred was a lot of upheaval, a lot of apathy in Vancouver, and the fact that Dan Hamhuis and Radim Verbata are still members of the Canucks today is surprising to a lot of people, including myself.
Ben, is there any chance either of Radim Verbata and Dan Hamhuis are going to be signed in the offseason?
Well, Verbata is probably going to be signed somewhere else. Here's the thing I don't understand about Verbata. Okay, you know he's 34 years old. You're probably not going to re-sign him because he's going to be 35 in the summer, and there's some wingers you need to take a look at, and you've got some pretty good kids. I guess what gets me is the fact that I understand Willie Desjardins wants to spread out his scoring, but if you're trying to up a value, if you're going to try to increase Verbata's worth at the trade deadline, why is he not playing with the Sedins? I mean, he plays with them on the power play. That's great, but the power play is not very good. It's one of the worst in the league. But he's a very much touchy-feely guy. It's all about chemistry with Verbata. And if he's not feeling it, I kind of think they might have lost that guy at training camp because he knew he wasn't playing with the Sedins. He didn't get out of the gate. He didn't score in his first six games. And he only had a dozen goals at the trade deadline. That didn't help him. He wasn't playing well. He's got a minor groin strain right now. And the Canucks were only offered a late-round pick for him, which is interesting because, you know, the piece I did with him at the trade deadline, I said, isn't it ironic because your buddy, Yuri Hudler, your countrymate, is 2 years younger than you. They get the Calgary Flames get a second and a fourth-round pick for guys who only got a few more goals than you. So I think what happened there is the fact that when people around the league look at Verbata right now, they look at a guy who maybe decided to check out at some point this season, was hurt, and that doesn't give you much on draft day. So right now, it's a situation with Verbata guys where, you know, he's got the minor groin strain. I was under the impression he was ready to play the other night, but with the kids playing as well as they are, the big question in Vancouver right now is when does Verbata get back into the lineup? And we can talk until Tuesday about Dan Hamhuis. I mean, there are a million stories about Dan Hamhuis. He said, she said. What were the real offers from Dallas? Dallas was obviously all over Chris Russell, and I think deep down the Canucks were hoping that Russell would have gone somewhere else and they would have had more leverage with the Stars. But there are some underlying things going on there. You know, we're told at one point that there was a similar package offered to the Canucks, maybe not as high a draft pick because we know that second round could convert into a first rounder should the Stars make the conference final. Then the Dallas Stars circling back at the Canucks late and wondering if they could also scoop up Hamhuis for what was, I'm led to believe, only a third-round pick. And, of course, that went over well like a lead balloon in Vancouver.
Ben, a big challenge for new general managers like Jim Benning is establishing kind of your reputation. And are you a hard negotiator in the market? How do you approach this? I mean, like you said, if we assume that Vancouver did have a deal on the table, is this something where you say, hey, take what we can get in our situation, or hold out and try to establish your reputation as not a pushover?
Yeah, that's a great comment because, you know, I kind of look at this hockey ops department, and don't get me wrong, they're nice guys, they're great guys to deal with, but most of them come from a playing or scouting background. You need to have the hard negotiator. To me, the Canucks are like, you know, there's a private party going on in the club, and the Canucks are out front, and they can't get past the velvet rope just to get into the building, let alone to get up to the VIP lounge and make the big deals. I get the impression they're kind of on the periphery here. They're not brokering the deals. You know, they're kind of talking to. I mean, you know, I don't know what the connection with Dallas is, and certainly the ownerships don't get along. That didn't help anything. You know, the teams you're dealing with. You know, there was some talk about some interest with Boston. Of course, Jim Benning has a history there, and who knows how that's going to play out in the off season with free agency. Because right now, I don't see these guys as. It's a big difference in the league between being an assistant general manager and being the general manager. And it's almost like a private boys club, and not sure the Canucks have that secret decoder ring working for them right now.
Ben, you talk about ownership you know, in Vancouver and Dallas not getting along. I guess it kind of leads me into the next question. Does Jim Benning have full autonomy and to make decisions, or how involved are Trevor Linden and ownership in these decisions for trades?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's incumbent upon any ownership group to be involved, but to what degree, right? I mean, you have to sign off on trades. You have to agree. I'm not so sure you'd be sitting at the draft table. That's a new one on me. I mean, usually when you go to the draft, right, the teams are on the floor. Every team has a private, you know, one of the private boxes up top, and usually once the kid is drafted, puts on the sweater, does the camera thing, meets with us, they go up to meet the owner in the suite. Well, Canucks owner has often been seen on the draft table floor, which to me would be a little bit uneasy for guys who spend 364 days scouting and then maybe have a different voice at the table. I think what's different in Vancouver is ownership is invested. Ownership has spent to the cap. There's a fine line between being a businessman and a fan, and I think sometimes those lines get blurred. And I think sometimes there's too much interference. I mean, who has to say? That's a great question. I mean, Trevor Linden is president of the hockey operations department. Okay, well, isn't that kind of a general manager's role? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's kind of a dual focus there. I mean, Trevor Linden was asked recently bluntly. He said that he had to say on decisions. Well, I guess as a president you should, but isn't that really the general manager's job? And usually a presidency is kind of overlooking the bigger picture. But Trevor Linden is very hands-on, having been so far removed from the game. And I think he'll be the first one to tell you that, you know, when Trevor Linden was hired, it was like, you know, the backup quarterback. Everybody loves the backup quarterback.
That's right.
You know, he isn't anything wrong.
That's right.
But Trevor is finding out in a hurry what this is all about. And personally, I think the mandate should be a little bit more defined. I think you've got two guys kind of acting in the same role.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ben Kuzma is our guest. Ben covers the Vancouver Canucks for the Vancouver Province. Ben, the Canucks did make a trade a couple days before the deadline. It certainly raised my eyebrows. They acquire Marcus Granlund from the Calgary Flames in exchange for Hunter Shinkaruk. What did you think about that trade, and you know, how did that come about?
Well, a lot of people thought it was odd because the Canucks can't score, and the first thing you're doing is giving up on a guy who had 21 goals at the time with Utica Comets. So it's kind of like we don't really understand what's going on here. He was only recalled once this year for a game in November in Montreal where he actually played in a bottom six role. And the thing about that night, he actually played well because that's a knock on him. He doesn't have that quote-unquote 200-foot game. He's not a big guy. I think what's happening, or what happened, was the fact that there was a consensus that his game would not translate to the NHL level, that the goals he's able to score in the American League are easier, that when you have to play in the dirty areas in the NHL and get to the net and stay there. I don't think they collectively believe that Shinkaruk could do that. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, if you connect the dots all the way back to the draft when, you know, Shinkaruk was selected by the Canucks. The Canucks assistant GM, John Weisbrod, was involved with the Flames at that point and passed on the local kid. and the Canucks took Shinkara 2 picks later. Well, fast forward, Weisbrod's the assistant general manager of the Canucks today, and they gave up on him, and I think Weisbrod had a lot to do with convincing his boss, Jim Benning, that, you know, he knew Granlin really well from his involvement in Calgary when Granlin was with the Abbotsford Heat. Granlin played pretty well with Berchi there. So they made that move because they think that Granlin has a more complete game. And I can only tell you from the few nights I've seen him play, I think they're right. He's always on the right side of the puck. He's very fast. He's very creative. He's developed some instant chemistry with Berchi. So interesting move there. And I think the thing about Shinkarak, he's got all the incentive in the world now to go back home and play very well for his hometown club. But when I look at it right now today, I understand why the Canucks made the move. And from the short-term study here on Granlin, it looks like maybe they made a right move for a change.
Ben, I know there's about a month left in the season here, but the Canucks are obviously, you know, in tough to make the playoffs this year. But when you look at the future of this team, you know, just over the next couple of years, and you consider that they might lose Radim Verbata, the Sedins are towards the end of their careers, do you think the Vancouver Canucks are going to be approaching the offseason saying, look, we're rebuilding, we got to make sure that we nail our draft picks with all the young prospects we have in the system, like Jake Virtanen and Jared McCann, Bo Horvat, Brock Besser at UND, guys like that. Do you think the Vancouver Canucks are going to be approaching the next couple of years as a rebuild?
I think they are. They hate to use the word, but, you know, I mean, even the captain's now talking about, you know, playing longer and can see what can play out here in the next couple of years. I mean, you know, Virtanen and Berchi and Ben Hutton, I mean, and especially Horvat in his sophomore year, I mean, they're here. They can play. I mean, they can play. They're not here because they don't have any alternatives. They can play. I mean, the other night in the first period against San Jose, I mean, Berchi and Granlin and Virtanen were very good in the first period. Virtanen might have been the best player on the ice. But as you know with kids, sustainability and compete level through 60 minutes is often a challenge. And when the Sharks decide to play, you're in a world of hurt. But they're there. They're the givens. And Ben Hutton, I mean, depending what happens with Dan Hamme, so, you know, the Canucks are, here's what's going to happen. They're going to have cap space. And you know they're going to chase a first-line right winger. And Jim Benning went on, you know, record again, saying, well, we've already identified people that we're interested in. And, well, if you're at the draft, you know they were chasing Milan Lucic. I'm not a big fan of Milan coming home at 28 and having all that pressure on him to be the first-line right winger. But they did chase him at the draft. And I think where ownership gets a little bit involved. Benning had him in Boston. And I think what bugs Benning sometimes is that the Canucks get rubbed out a little bit on the walls. And that's going to be interesting. You know, they're going to go after a first-line right winger. But, you know, after that, I mean, the way that Virtanen has played this year, I mean, he looks like he might even be a second-line right winger next year. I mean, he's advancing that quickly. It's hard to get a read on Besser. I mean, he's having an outstanding year at North Dakota. He's leading all first-year forwards in goals. And I've done stories on him and watched him play. And he's going to be fast-tracked. I don't know how quickly they can get him here. I can't see him staying in North Dakota very much longer. So, you know, that's a good thing there. I think how it plays out on the back end is going to be a real question mark. Dan Hamhuis, you know, has probably one more contract in him, one lengthy, multi-year market value deal. I can't see him getting money and term in Vancouver. He loves Vancouver. He wants to resign. He had the full no trade. That's why he didn't go anywhere. Mind you, he would have been willing to go to Dallas. But having said that, if they want him back, he's going to have to take a pay cut. And I think that's going to be a very difficult conversation because he took one to come to Vancouver. So if he's not in the mix, you know, you've got Edler and Tanev and you've got Ben Hutton as your number three, and then it gets kind of murky after that. You know, is Lucas Pisa really a number four? They're really high on Andre Pedan, who's having a good year with Utica Comets, and they're trying to get Nikita Trimenkin out of the KHL to have a look at him here before the end of the year. He's a 6'8" defenseman. I mean, his team just got eliminated in the KHL, so he's under contract till the end of April, so the Canucks have to try to get him out of that contract, and he can only come as he would have had to have his season finished by the end of February and be under contract here to be assigned to the American Hockey League. So he would have to come straight here at. And I talked to Jim Benning the other day, and they're very anxious to get that done. And so you're going to have probably another look at Pedan here by the end of the year, and you're going to have another look at, or first look at Treminck, and they've got, you know, some other depth guys. So the back end's always going to be a problem here. In the big picture, the Canucks would like to get a top four D-man. That's going to be very expensive, especially in free agency. Most of them are old and not that effective, so they might have to do it in-house, and that's going to be an ongoing concern here.
Last one for you, Ben. Quickly, when Brandon Sutter was acquired this summer, you could see it was really to insulate Bo Horvat and not throw him into a second-line center role in a very tough Western Conference. With Sutter's sports hernia injury earlier, now the long-term jaw injury, Horvat's been thrown into that role a little sooner than expected. How has he handled that? What are your impressions so far?
Well, I think he's handled it. I think the problem with Bo playing second-line center, it comes with offensive expectation, and I think that's where he struggled in the first part of this year. You know, he's an interesting guy. He's almost like a 2.5 center. Like he's not maybe quite a second liner, but he's better than a third-line center because he's very responsible. What they've done the last couple games is actually put him down on the third line. You know, he was playing with Vey, and they're trying to work something out in the sense that Horvat's better in transition. It's suddenly, if you tell Bo, you're our third line center tonight, then suddenly he gets his defensive game back, and he's very good down low. His defensive awareness and his defensive zone faceoffs are very much better than they were, and then the offense transitions out of that. So I think in a perfect world, Bo Horvat might be a third line center next year. But I don't know what you do with Brandon Sutter. I really don't. I like him better on the wing than I do in the middle. My biggest concern with him coming to this division and this conference is that you're going to get beat up one way or the other. It's very, very physical. And he's a really good skater. He's a good playmaker. And I wonder, and they had him on the wing with the Sedins at one point this year, and he played some second-line wing. I wonder, in the big picture, if he's not a better right winger, and then, of course, you have that second guy to take a draw if your center gets punted out. So we'll see how that goes. But he's a better player than I thought. So, you know, that's one thing that's kind of lost here, the fact that you lose Brandon Sutter, you lose Alex Edler of late, you probably lost your season.
Ben Kuzma covers the Vancouver Canucks for the Vancouver Province. Ben, always appreciate your time and insight into the Canucks. And thanks again for joining us on this morning's Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Take care.
You too, Ben. Take care. Let's head to break. You're listening to an IC Saturday on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday here on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Ben Kuzma from the Vancouver Province and Amanda Stein of TSN 690 in Montreal for joining us on the program. In case you missed any of those interviews, they'll be available for download on iTunes and on our website, illegalcurve.com. Still to come on the show, ESPN's Scott Burnside joins us to talk about the World Cup of Hockey rosters that were announced. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors is last night in town. Randy Litke is in town, and we will give away four tickets to caller number three right now to go see Kelly Taylor this coming Tuesday at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. So caller number three to 780-1290. You win four tickets to see Kelly Taylor, the pride of Saskatchewan, coming up this coming Tuesday at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. 780-1290 to caller number three.
I'm calling right now.
You actually are calling. I'm not sure what you're doing, but you're not eligible to win, unfortunately. Anyways, Western Conference playoff race, down to really two teams for one final spot. That is the Minnesota Wild and the Colorado Avalanche. They enter tonight's action tied with 70 points each, and each having the same number of regulation and overtime wins, which is the first tiebreaker, each of them with 30 of those. The Wild do have one game in hand on the Avs. The big news between those two teams is the Wild beat the Avs earlier this week, and Calvin Pickard is the new Avalanche number one goaltender, according to head coach Patrick Waugh, as Semyon Varlamov has been struggling, and Pickard is taking over as the number one goalie.
The Winnipeg guy.
Of course.
And it goes to Mike's point earlier about the Russian goaltending, you know, what the question marks surrounding that. So that's an interesting time to make a significant change like that. And Drew, one thing when I look at you put together a nice spreadsheet here in terms of the games that they have left, and I'll let you speak to that in a second, but when you look at their schedules and even and you look at just the standings, well, I think one thing that I take from that is different teams now. I mean, sure, I mean, the standings and the numbers, goals for, goals against, they give you an indicator of the teams, but you have no Mike Yeo anymore. Colorado has changed netminders, added Michael Bodker, more significant, obviously, than Jelena on the back end. But these teams are a little bit different, so I think the past certainly gives you there's a predictive element to it, but it's also a bit of a change in terms of different coach, different players.
If you look at the stats right now, if you check out Sports Club Stats, which always calculates the odds of a team making the playoffs and everything else, even though the Wild and the Avs are tied with points, the Wild have a 75.7% chance of making the playoffs, whereas the Wild only have a 27.3% chance. And I think the reason for that speaks to the opponents that the two teams have over the remainder of the year. The Wild have a very soft schedule from now until the end of the regular season. They only have six games versus playoff teams, one game against the Avalanche. They play each other one more time. So the Wild have six games against playoff teams. Meanwhile, the Avs have 10 games left against playoff teams. That's including the one game against the Wild. And the Avs finished the season with eight straight games against playoff teams from March 26th through April 9th. So if the Avs are able to make it ahead of the Wild, they're certainly going to earn it by beating up some of the better teams in the NHL.
Yeah, and this is going to be, guys, one of the best races to watch here over
the
next
race.
Well, there's also a race for the division lead between Tampa Bay and Florida, which is going to be fascinating. Both of those teams are going to be fighting down to the wire.
Quickly, though, Izzy, that may be a race one of those teams wants to lose, depending on who their first round matchup is. Where here, none of these teams want to lose.
It's possible, Richie. But when you look at this race, the Central Division race for the last wild card spot, Avalanche play tonight at home to the Nashville Predators. The Minnesota Wild don't play. The Avalanche actually play this afternoon. The Minnesota Wild play tomorrow. And when you look at these two teams, you know, I agree, Drew, I've looked at the schedule, and the Colorado Avalanche clearly have the tougher schedule. And when I look at these two teams, either one of these teams misses the playoffs, it's going to be extremely disappointing. And you could probably say that maybe it's more disappointing for the Minnesota Wild because they have the more expensive roster. They have more veterans. Colorado's a younger team. But this Colorado team missing the playoffs last year after winning the division, I mean, this team wants to go to the playoffs. And Richie mentioned, you know, the Avalanche, Joe Sakic acquiring Mikael Bodker and Eric Jelena. Bodker, you know, it's possible that that's a rental and they don't keep him. But needless to say, they're going for it. I mean, they acquired those players because they want to make the playoffs. So this is going to be a fascinating race. It's probably going to come down to the final couple games.
When it comes to Minnesota, I think they'll live and die by Devan Dubnyk. And we saw what he was capable of last year when they went on that run. I think that will determine their fate. I think you mentioned Bodker. That's, to me, the thing to watch with Colorado now. You've got a guy that can skate with Nathan MacKinnon. Mm-hmm. And if you're Mikael Bodker, I believe he turned down a five-year deal worth $5.5 million with Arizona. I mean, he could cash in. With that opportunity alongside MacKinnon and Landeskog, I think is a really interesting storyline and changes the dynamic, like you guys said, of this Colorado team. Jerome Iginla is not a guy that can skate with MacKinnon. He's on a line right now with Matt Duchene. He can't skate with him. And so he's a slow fit on a very fast Avalanche team. It'll be interesting to see how that speed and skill plays out in a very heavy Western Conference.
And then that's, you know, the contrast in styles between these two teams. You know, a Wild team that, sure, Torchetti, there might be some changes, and there will be some changes, but you can't change the complexion of the roster and of the strengths are. The Wild are not a fast team. And the Avalanche, as you mentioned, are a fast team. Get faster with that addition. They want to push the pace. They want to take more chances. So that goaltending is obviously so important. You know, you even look at the back end. They added in a guy who cleaned off waivers and Admu Bodnarchuk, another quick skater. So they're going to push the pace, be quick, fast. And a guy like Iginla might have trouble. And Grigorenko also a similar problem with his foot speed. But also added Sean Matthias. So it's been a ton of additions here, kind of for a short term. So I think, as he was mentioning earlier, I still agree the disappointment will be greater for Minnesota because I think it probably cost Chuck Fletcher his job. But the Avalanche brass has put more into this team in short term than the Wild have.
Time to break. When we come back, Scott Burnside of ESPN.com joins us to talk about the World Cup of Hockey roster unveiling. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday on TSN 1290. Shortly after 11:30 in the morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, alongside analyst Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Special guest in studio with us, Mike Colligan, has joined us for the last 2.5 hours. We're impressed anybody can spend 2.5 straight hours with us that's not obligated to do so, but of course we are thrilled Mike's here in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the program Scott Burnside of ESPN.com. Scott, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Ah, my pleasure. How's the weather? I will tell you here in Atlanta, it's about 65 and sunny. So.
It's not quite 65 and sunny here in Winnipeg, but it's maybe about 35 and sunny. So, you know, minus those 30 degrees, it's almost the same thing.
Yeah, well, then as long as the sun's shining, that's all you can ask for.
Exactly right. We agree with you wholeheartedly. Scott, we brought you on to talk about the World Cup of Hockey. The big announcement of the preliminary rosters occurred earlier this week on Wednesday. You know, now that you're, I mean, I don't know what your excitement level has been about the tournament from the start. We were talking about it, you know, from way back when it was announced that we were sort of a little bit lukewarm about the tournament, maybe because it's not a complete best-on-best format, the bizarre under-23 teams and the bizarre, you know, sort of Team Europe hybrid. But now that the tournament has players assigned to each team and it's sort of becoming, you know, it's within grasp of how close it is your excitement level ramping up for this tournament to start coming up here in September?
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to have been, you know, whether it's lukewarm or not, but, you know, certainly hard to get your head around that it was actually going to happen and what kind of event it was going to be like, and certainly with the introduction of two hybrid teams. Now, I would take issue with the idea that it's not truly a best-on-best, because I think, frankly, what you're going to see with this tournament with the eight teams is that you are going to see, you know, maybe for the first time in maybe forever, but certainly back into the heyday of the World Cup of Hockey, you are going to see the highest percentage of the world's best hockey players. And, you know, with all due respect to players from Switzerland or Germany or Slovenia or Austria, you know, if it is a more traditional tournament, and that may yet happen in 2020 when the second of the new revised World Cup of Hockey takes place, you know, those teams do not, they don't have the hockey population to populate an entire team of elite hockey players. And, that, you know, there's no question that's why the NHLPA and the NHL decided to go to this hybrid event, because, you know, I think the Finns had a couple of KHL players. You know, at some point the Russians may add a couple, whether it's Radulov or Kovalchuk, although he's got his own issues. But, you know, 98% of the players named of the, you know, of the 8 times 16, and I'm doing the little rough math, they're all NHL players, and they're the world's best NHL players. And, you know, hopefully we'll see Jaromir Jagr suiting up for the Czech team as well. He wasn't named for the initial 16 at his own request, but, you know, these are the best players in the world right now, and we are going to see, I think, an incredible level of hockey. And, you know, whether there becomes a following for Team North America or Team Europe, and whether they're able to gel and create an identity that fans will get behind and, you know, make them more than an oddity, I think is a challenge for the coaching and management team for both those squads. But I think the fans are enthused by it. And I think the players, when you talk to them, as we get closer, people want to know whether Team North America is going to knock someone off. I think people are curious, what's Team Europe going to be like? Are they going to be better than the Russians, say, because their team defense and goaltending looks right now to be better than the Russians? And, you know, where do the Swedes fit into this? A team sort of, you know, forgotten a little bit, and yet, you know, player for player might be the best team, bar none, in the tournament. I mean, and I think you're right. The naming of the first 16 has made this kind of discussion, you know, it's brought it a little bit more sharply into focus.
Scott, we went over all of the teams, with the exception of the Czech Republic team, last hour, and we were focusing a lot on Canada and the USA. When the preliminary rosters were named earlier this week, what were the biggest surprises for you? I know here in Canada, a lot of people were surprised, for example, that P.K. Subban and Corey Perry were left off the Team Canada team. Were you surprised by Subban and Perry not being included on Team Canada? What were some of the other roster surprises for you?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised that the Perry, I guess it's initial snub, but certainly disappointment for Corey Perry, and not my, my guess is, especially because I think the Ducks have the potential to have a long and successful playoff run, that Corey Perry will be among the final seven announced June 1st. I was less surprised by P.K. Subban, but that's only because I know how strident Mike Babcock and, as a result, I think the Canadian management team is going to be about that complete balance of right-left shots on that Canadian blue line. I see that there's no reason for them to go away from the blueprint that was so wildly successful in Sochi. So, and there are a lot of hard decisions for right-handed defensemen or defensemen on the right hand, the right side for Canada. So I wasn't surprised by that. I guess for me, with Team USA, I was a little bit surprised that Dustin Byfuglien was named initially. I had him on my shadow roster as sort of a seventh defenseman. So I'm not surprised that he's on the team. I was surprised that he was named ahead of a guy like Justin Falk, who's having an absolutely banner year in Carolina. And who I still think will be on the final roster for Team USA. And I was surprised a little bit by Phil Kessel's exclusion. I just thought that he would be in that group. And again, I think that what Dean Lombardi and the U.S. management team has done is thrown down the gauntlet to a handful of wingers to say, okay, show me, right? I mean, should we take Phil Kessel? Well, prove it to me. Should we take Kyle Okposo? Should we take Nick Foligno? Now, the problem for Foligno, unless he has a banner world championship, the Columbus Blue Jackets won't be in the playoffs. But, Kyle Okposo is going to get a chance to prove his worth. So is Phil Kessel, assuming that the Penguins do find their way into the playoffs. So I think, those are, the challenges are for players to separate themselves from the pack and be part of that final seven group. And I think right off the top of my head, I think there are four more forwards to go and three defensemen. I think that's right. But, I think that's right. And so, the challenge is on. Kevin Shattenkirk was another guy along the U.S. blue line that I had, I had him penciled in as a lock pretty much all the way along. But that's, to me, that's the exciting part about this. I'll be candid. I didn't have Justin Abdelkader from the Red Wings on any shadow roster at any point. So, what do I know? But I think it speaks to the depth the Americans have to deal with and the kind of team that they're going to want to build and what kind of identity are they going to have in Toronto. And my guess is it'll be more closely aligned with the U.S. identity in 2010 in Vancouver, which was a more rugged, gritty, lunch bucket type team that plays a Los Angeles Kings style of hockey. No surprise there with Dean Lombardi. So, it'll be interesting to see how that shakes down with the final seven announcements for Team USA.
Well, certainly John Tortorella fits into that mold as well as far as playing defensive hockey, shutdown hockey. And as you look at how this team was constructed and think back to even the Sochi Olympics, I remember you had a great coverage on how they constructed that roster and David Poile took his approach to the team. Are we expecting Olympic-style hockey here? Teams will have maybe 10 days of training camp and three pre-tournament games. Will that change anything? Will we see more systems and structure? Or is this going to be a lot more like that Vancouver Olympics?
Well, I think this is why this tournament is so exciting, because while it's not like the old-style Canada Cups where players will come and possibly get cut from their team, right? Players are going to come to camp knowing they've made the team, but they're going to have to play for spots on the roster and where they fit in. I think the fact that they're going to have practices, have a couple of exhibition games before the tournament gets started, when you think about the Olympic experience, I love the Olympics, but it is a mad scramble, right? I mean, I remember going to, and I think it might have been Torino, some flights got delayed because of storms. I mean, people were literally getting off the plane and putting on gear and going to the rink, within 12 or 14 hours and, stepping into the preliminary round of Olympic competition. Well, this is going to be a little bit different. And yeah, it's after the summer, so they won't be in mid-season form, but I think we're going to see better hockey. And I think we're going to see better hockey because it's on the NHL style ice in Toronto. Teams will have found the time to find their line combinations, forge some sort of identity before we go in. And I think we're going to see, because the competition is going to be so keen, that right from the get-go, like teams can't afford to have two or three bad games, right? I mean, you've got to get off the mark quickly to assure yourself a spot beyond the first round robin part. So I think the hockey will be much better. I think it'll be much more NHL style, which I think is will be more closely resembling what we saw in Vancouver, which was, you know, for me, the finest collection of hockey games I've ever seen in a 2-week period of time. So I'm looking forward to that part of it because the dynamics, I think, set us up to see absolutely wonderful hockey.
Scott, in terms of ticket sales, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, NHL, NHLPA work together here to make money, and that's usually when they're working best together is when they're looking to make money that maybe wasn't there before. Look at the tickets packages on sale now through the World Cup of Hockey website. Looks like you can get in the building for the back of the ACC for about $100 a game if you put up for 17-game package. Do you think this tournament will sell well?
I mean, it's interesting because you hear rumblings. Oh, because there's no question, right? You can't get in there cheaply, at least not now. But I know Gary Bettman was unequivocal in Nashville when I asked him about it, and he insists that he believes that all seats will be sold for every game when the dust clears and when the puck drops on the 17th of September. We'll see. I think it's pivotal that they do sell out, that the crowds are there. I mean, we've seen some, hiccups for international hockey, and maybe it's not fair to compare them, but, when you see Montreal and Toronto with the World Juniors and some issues with ticket prices in Montreal and empty seats, and, it would be embarrassing, I think, if this tournament starts and, that there are great wads of empty seats for preliminary games, not including Canada, the U.S., or Team North America, which will obviously be the big draws. But, my guess is because there are only eight teams, that the fans will show up and they will pay the price. Now, that's a big gamble, right? That's why the NHL and PA went to Toronto. It's why they're not moving it around. Historically, the World Cup has seen the tournament games themselves in different locations in Canada and the United States. And the feeling was, let's put it in Toronto. The fans will travel there. There's lots of money there. There's corporates, all those reasons. There's no excuse for them not to sell out unless they have misjudged the market. And, right now, people seem optimistic that they haven't.
Final question for you, Scott. This will be the return of significance of ESPN to covering the National Hockey League and the World Cup. What do you think this means? Like, how do you think the ESPN will approach the coverage? Will it affect how many hockey highlights are in SportsCenter coming down the stretch run of the playoffs here? And how many resources do you think they're going to allot to this tournament?
That's a question that far exceeds my pay grade. But, I can tell you this, there's always been, certainly you haven't been down there for 11 years, that we've always had tremendous support for the online coverage and have never felt like second-class citizens. It would be nice to have hockey highlights in every single segment of SportsCenter. If I was in charge, we'd see a lot more hockey there, but I've not been tasked with that as of yet. But I do think that you've seen over the last year or so, hockey's presence is different, and I think that speaks to the profile of the game across North America and the world. And I think you'll see more of that between now and when the games start and they are on our screens in the United States. And I can only tell you how it is, working there, and that there's a tremendous buzz about it. And I know when you talk to players and coaches and GMs, they're excited that this tournament is going to be on our screen. So, what else am I going to say? But I think it's tremendous. And we certainly are looking forward to the opportunity to cover it, and to be part of it. So I'm looking forward to that part.
Scott Burnside covers the NHL. He's going to cover the World Cup of Hockey as well for ESPN.com. Scott, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime, guys.
Take care, Scott. Thanks very much. Let's head to break. When we come back, we got one final segment for you. As we head to break, shout out to Jonathan Thiessen. He won the 4 tickets to Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club this coming Tuesday. More tickets to be given away next week on the show. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday on TSN 1290. One final segment to go this Saturday morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Mike, you made it. You survived 2 hours and 50 minutes with us so far. You think you can make it for the last 10 minutes here?
It's nice and warm in the studio. I can go all day if we need to.
Okay, well, there you go. Mike Colligan joining us in studio. Normally covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. He covers the NHL for Forbes Sports Money. He's visiting Winnipeg to watch a couple of the Jets games this weekend, so we're thrilled to have him in studio. One final segment this Saturday morning. It's called
Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire. We'll start with Team Czech Republic because we forgot to do them or ran out of time in doing them when we were looking at the entirety of the World Cup of Hockey rosters. Your impressions of Team Czech Republic for the upcoming World Cup of Hockey. Is this a team that's just sort of one step behind all the other elite teams in the world?
No Jaromír Jágr. I think, remember, he asked out of the All-Star game, sure. Somehow ended up there. I wonder if we see him swoop in late and salvage at least some respectability for this team.
His defense is just terrible. I mean, they can't compete with that defense.
Yeah.
Probably finish last with that defense.
Yeah, the defense is not as good as some of the other top teams like Canada and Sweden. Goaltending, though, is very strong with Mrazek and Neuwirth there, and nice to see Andrei Pavlik make the team. But I don't think this Czech Republic team is going to compete for the gold medal, but I also don't think they're going to be a pushover.
Forwards are pretty solid, but you look at the way these teams are all put together, it seems like defense is going to be more important than ever, so...
They're going to be teammates at the upcoming World Cup of Hockey. That's Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel. They played against each other for the first time this season, and much was made about the rivalry, the quote-unquote rivalry between the two players. Do you think that such a rivalry exists, and can you have a rivalry when your teams only play each other twice per season?
Well, not only that, I mean, Connor McDavid played in the Ontario Hockey League, and Jack Eichel played in the USHL and then played NCAA. So these guys didn't play against each other. Unless you count international competition. So I don't know how big of a rivalry there is between these two guys, but certainly they're always going to be linked because they were drafted 1 and 2 at the 2015 draft. So I think there's the chance that there could be a nice little rivalry similar to Crosby and Ovechkin, you know, 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, other than a Stanley Cup final someday, I don't think we'll ever see that hatred really develop between the two teams, let alone the two players that don't seem to have those personalities anyway. They're not like Alex Ovechkin, and I think when you look at just two games a year, that's why the NHL realigned these divisions, was to get more volume of rivalry games. When you're only seeing each other so few games, it's very tough to really develop any kind of competitive rivalry.
Yeah, McDavid came out this week, said, you know, I don't really even know Eichel. Sure. We don't really know each other. So I think more is made about it, I think, than some people think.
I mean, Hall and Sagan, remember how much that was hyped up as kind of the huge one-two?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You never hear about it anymore. I don't think we've talked about it.
And they at least play each other more than twice a year now that Sagan's in Dallas and not in Boston, where, of course, he started. Dion Phaneuf returns to Toronto tonight for the first time since being traded to Ottawa. What kind of reception do you think he should and will get from the crowd at the ACC in Toronto?
I think... He'll just get light up. He should get light applause just because, I mean, he is what he is. I think he was made out to be something that he wasn't, and that was the fault of the management at the time and the coaching staff making him captain. And I think the expectations were never in line with the player that he was. And he didn't become the player that he, to me, could have been. But I think the reaction will be apathy because absolutely nobody will be in that building tonight.
I think he handled himself pretty well. All things considered, compared to what he did on the way out of Calgary, that sounded a lot more explosive than what I thought was a respectable last 12 months there in Toronto and with a media that was really trying to trip him up at every opportunity. So I think from that standpoint, certainly has matured as a player and as a man in his last few years here.
Yeah, well said, Mike. I think, by the way, Dion Phaneuf said yesterday he's not sure how fans were going to greet him. I agree with Richie. I think, you know, fans are going to applaud him. I think he was a good captain. Maybe he wasn't the best interview. He's kind of a soft-spoken guy. But he
at least did the interviews.
He did the interviews.
That's
always.
Not easy to do in that market.
Always. After all games, you're right, Richie, as the captain, he would do the interviews, and I agree with you. I think he was maybe miscast as a number one defenseman in Toronto
when
he's maybe a third or fourth defenseman on a good team.
Yep.
So I do think that the fans, Toronto fans are classy. I think they'll cheer him.
Things have gone south for Ilya Kovalchuk in the KHL this season. He has been a healthy scratch in the playoffs and has been stripped of his team's captaincy, fueling rumors that he may return to the NHL. Given the manner in which he left the New Jersey Devils, should they have first right of refusal on a returning Kovalchuk, and should he be able to return to the NHL without serving some sort of punishment for up and quote-unquote retiring years ago?
I don't know enough about the details of the rules, and we were kind of discussing that off air. I would say that if the Devils were to have first right of refusal to him coming back, it would have to be under the terms of the contract that he left out from under.
With the same salary cap hit.
So, and all of that stuff. And if not, then if that's not going to be a parameter, then I don't see why they'd have any more right to anybody else to he'd be a free agent if the contract was terminated. And technically, I don't know if it was.
I don't believe it was. I think he was voluntarily retired.
Either you're a free agent, everybody, or you're a Devil under that contract to me.
Despite what was a low cap hit of $6.6 million, this was a guy that would have been making $12 million a season. And I think it's ridiculous that New Jersey was able to get out from under that, which was,
for sure.
I mean, how many teams would love to have that flexibility and just aren't allowed to do it? Now to bring him back, you got to have some kind of recapture-like penalty like we see with some of these front-loaded deals now. Otherwise, you'll have 29 other GMs and owners up in arms.
Yeah, I agree with Rich. I mean, the terms of the contract are a little bit dicey as far as if New Jersey is able to use him next year, if Ilya Kovalchuk does want to come back. It sounds like there's a chance that he does want to come back. The other question for me, guys, is, you know, Kovalchuk's 32 years old now. He's been putting up some decent numbers over in the KHL. But, you know, the question for me is, do Ray Shiro and the Devils want Ilya Kovalchuk? I mean, the Devils have had a surprising season. They've got some good young players there. They could certainly use him, but does he factor into the plans? And do teams want to sign him? Like, he's not the same 26, 27-year-old Ilya Kovalchuk, but I still think he could make an impact on a team, though, having said that.
You watch him in the Olympics, his pace at Czech, he was not able to keep up. In my opinion, he was certainly in the short term of that tournament, he was not able to play at that same pace. Now, you know, Mike makes a good point about getting out from under and a recapture. Like, either there's a contract or there's not. Like, either it was terminated, and that's the way the NHL approached it, probably unfairly, for whatever reason, or there is a contract, and then he's coming back under that contract, and then the Devils have to look to move that contract, and maybe that is retaining salary as part of that deal.
Because the World Cup of Hockey primarily is a vehicle just to make money for the NHL and NHLPA, they came out with new jerseys for all 8 teams. Your thoughts on the new jerseys that were released alongside the team announcements on Wednesday?
I mean, overall, I'd say pretty, probably about a 4 out of 10. Like, I think Sweden, the U.S., Russia, and Czechs, I'm totally okay with. I do not like Canada's jersey. I have no clue what the Europe and North American jersey designer was thinking. And Finland's okay.
We might have to talk to our buddy Keener from Keener Jerseys in the coming weeks.
Yeah, we should ask him. We should have him on to talk to him about the 8 jerseys. Because this North American jersey, like,
yeah.
First of all, I can't figure out what the European jersey is. I mean, maybe I'm missing something. Is there a symbol there that I'm unaware of?
Guys, I didn't mind the Team Canada jersey just because I like any jersey that has a maple leaf on it. But, I mean, overall...
Is that a maple leaf, by the way?
Overall, I mean, the jerseys were, you know, just okay. Some of them, I think, left a little bit to be desired there.
Adidas is making the jerseys, so they may have replaced the maple leaf with the Adidas weed logo instead. I'm not sure if they did that or not. Anyways, that's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, Riverview Health Center Foundation, Cycle on Life, Keener Jerseys, and the Rady JCC Sports Dinner. Big thanks to producer Eric. Big thanks to Mike Colligan for joining us for all 3 hours. For Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.